The first reading of today is from Isaiah 53, the verses 1 to 6, which you can find inside the notices and on page 613. Isaiah 53, 1 to 6, page 613. Who has believed what he has heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form of majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. That he was wounded for our transgressions, he was crushed for our acquaintances. Upon him we have chastened that brought us peace, and with stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray, we have turned on every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all.
And the second reading is from Matthew chapter 8, verse 14 to 17, on page 813 in the Bibles in front of you. Matthew chapter 8, verses 14 to 17. And when Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she rose and began to serve him. That evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases.
Thank you, Andrew and Florentine, for reading. And hello from me. I'm Andrew, one of the pastors here. It's great to see such a big crowd of people on Palm Sunday. So this is traditionally the Sunday when Christians remember Jesus arriving in Jerusalem at the beginning of the week when he would be killed. And so Friday of this week is Good Friday, when we remember Jesus' death. And then Sunday, next Sunday, is Easter Sunday, when we remember his resurrection. So we're thinking today about the cross of Jesus, hence all the songs, hence the children's talk, hence this passage. From many hundreds of years before Jesus, the prophet Isaiah foretelling what would happen when God's king came to earth. Now, I want to begin, though, by asking this question. Do you find it hard to admit that you're wrong? It's not really a question, because I know that you do, right? This is a universal human thing. We hate to admit that we're wrong or that we've made a mistake. I mean, even to the extent that if you're walking along and you suddenly fall down a hole or something, or there's a massive pothole there, and then you act like, oh, yeah, of course I knew that was there. And, you quickly recover. And even if it really, really hurts, you pretend it didn't hurt, because you don't want to lose face to know that you've been stupid. It's really difficult to admit that you're wrong. Elton John said, sorry seems to be the hardest word. And I think it's because at the heart of sorry is, I was wrong. I'm sorry, I got it wrong. I treated you wrong. I made a mistake. I now regret it. We find it hard to do that. And actually, this inability to say that we're wrong, it means that people get stuck in something that's wrong, because they can't just admit it. Rather than lose face, I'll just double down. I wonder whether that's true of world leaders, for example. Do you think it's occurred to Vladimir Putin, maybe that was wrong? But you can't lose face, right? You can't just retreat and lose it. I've got to double. No, this was my plan all along, to invade Ukraine and have a 3-year war and it not go anywhere and thousands of people be killed. Of course, that was entirely what I planned, because it's so hard to say, I got it wrong. Maybe the same is true of Hamas terrorists. We were wrong. not just on the global stage, though, is it? It's us. I mean, in relationships, when we've invested in something, when we've backed something. And of course, it's one of the hardest things when it comes to Christianity, because Jesus' ideas are so upside down for our world. They're so different to what we thought before. And always, as we come to Jesus, he's going to invite us to say at some point, I was wrong about you. I want to say in this sermon, I haven't plagiarized the whole thing. I haven't. But it is inspired by a talk I heard on this passage by an American preacher called Ralph Davis. And you know, I don't know whether this is true for you, but sometimes particular sermons I heard just have lodged with me. They sort of moved me so much, I've never been able to forget them. And he preached on this passage, and his introduction was, I was wrong, and it's inspired this introduction. I actually haven't been able to find the sermon online. I think it's been taken down. But I kind of remember the illustration he used. And there was a New Testament professor back in the 1950s called Etta Linnemann, a German textual critic scholar. So she was something of a rising star of the academy. She published very young, lots of scholarly articles and books, and she sort of won various prizes. But she is very dismissive of the Bible. She kind of wrote books to explain away the stories of Jesus. And then she became a Christian. And she wrote this, and this was Darrell Davis' illustration. I managed to find it online. She says this: I regard everything that I taught and wrote before I entrusted my life to Jesus as refuse. And then she mentions various scholarly books and journal articles that she'd written. She says this: whatever of these writings I had in my possession, I threw into the trash with my own hands in 1978. I ask you sincerely to do the same with any of them you may have on your bookshelf. That's pretty cool, isn't it? Like, to put it another way, I was wrong. You know, I renounce my former writings, my publications. I've thrown them away. I beg you to throw them away if you have any in your... It's hard to say that, isn't it? About a whole academic career. It's hard to say that about a whole life. I got it wrong. But that is the right introduction for this passage. And I've not spotted this for a while, but actually Isaiah begins talking about Jesus on the cross, this prophecy of what's going to happen later. He begins by saying, you know, I got this wrong. Let's just look with me at the beginning again. Who has believed what is heard from us? As Isaiah, and the implied answer is virtually no one. Like, everyone thinks this is ridiculous. Who's believed us? Almost no one. To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Almost hardly anyone. For he grew up before him like a young plant. This is a metaphor for Jesus being like a little shoot. If you're doing Isaiah in our grace groups on Wednesdays, you'll know that Isaiah uses this metaphor of Jesus being like a sprout that comes up from a tree that looked like it had been cut down. It looked like everything, all the hope had been lost. And then whoop, this little shoot sprouts up. He was like a little plant, like a little root. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him. He had no beauty that we should desire him. In other words, if this was happening sort of 2,000 years ago, and it wouldn't have been happening, would it? Because we wouldn't have had all these songs to sing, because they're Christian songs. But imagine if we were a group of people gathering 2,000 years ago, and Jesus was sitting somewhere in the room, he wouldn't be the most handsome person in the room. There wouldn't be anything about him that you would notice, really. He would be the sort of the nobody. There's nothing impressive about him, says Isaiah. There was no beauty or no majesty. You wouldn't go, oh, I think that guy looks like he's a bit sort of king-like or a bit godlike. You just go, oh, he's that bloke. An ordinary Middle Eastern man. Nothing exceptional about him. It's one of the reasons I can't watch depictions of Jesus in films. Personally, I'm not against you. If you watch The Chosen or something, fair enough. People find it helpful. I can't watch it because the person playing Jesus is usually too handsome or too special, or, you know, he wasn't special. You would not have noticed him. And in fact, it's worse than that. It's not just that he was an ordinary bloke, But then he died a shameful death. Isaiah continues, verse 3. He was despised. People hated him. He wasn't like averagely popular. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised. That's pretty despised, isn't it? On a scale of how despised you are, when people go, oh no, and they instinctively turn away. Maybe you do that if you see someone who's been disfigured somehow in some sort of accident, and you're a bit ashamed of it. You don't want to turn away, but you don't want to look. That's what people are like with Jesus. Oh no, no. Like somebody from whom men hide their faces, he was despised. And then this is the striking thing. We esteemed him not. So Isaiah is saying about Jesus, the one he now thinks is God's glorious king, he's saying in a phrase, I was wrong about him. I drew the wrong conclusion about Jesus. I got it wrong. I think that's very striking. It's very striking to hear a Jewish prophet say that, right? You think, surely the prophet gets it right. No, the prophet gets it wrong. And of course, all of us get it wrong. I mean, the whole world gets it wrong. There's an outline on the service sheet on the inside if you want to have a look. And this is our first point. We were wrong. It's true the world in general, so the world outside the church, gets it wrong about Jesus. People find the idea of Jesus dying on a cross a sort of weird thing, a pathetic thing. So here's a quote from 1 Corinthians about how the Christian message went down in the Greek world. I've just been in Athens, got back yesterday, and it's very impressive, you know, all these amazing pillars and statues, and you know, it was once the superpower of the world, all the greatest minds, and Socrates is down here, and Heraclitus is over there, and what did they think about Jesus, all these philosophers? How weird. What, you're worshipping someone who died in weakness. Paul summarizes his attempt to get through to people in Corinth, in Greece. He says, Christ crucified is a stumbling block to Jews and folly, stupidity to Gentiles, to Greeks. Like, this is such a weird idea. There's even a bit of graffiti. Some of you have seen it, and if you haven't, I should have put it on the handout, sorry, but you can Google it very easily. It's called the Alexamenos graffiti, and it's spelt how it sounds, Alexamenos, and it was found in the Palatine Hill in Rome from the probably 3rd century AD, and it's a graffiti of a man bowing down in worship before a figure on a cross with a donkey's head, and the inscription underneath said, Alexamenos worships his god. As if to say, what a loser, this Christian, what a fool, worshipping someone who died in weakness, and hence the donkey's head, just to mock the whole thing. Just seems weird that your god should die. And it's not just that he doesn't look like a god, although I guess he doesn't when he's dying on a cross, but also the very idea of kind of celebrating weakness and death seems offensive. So here's Nietzsche, the famous atheistic philosopher of the last century. He says this, the Christian conception of God, God as God of the sick, God as spider. I mean, the Bible never calls God a spider, but you know, it's the idea of that, it's insect God, this weak God, God as spirit, is one of the most corrupt conceptions of God arrived at on earth. Perhaps it even represents the low watermark in the descending development of the God type. God degenerated to the contradiction of life. Nietzsche was all about power and getting ahead. He said, look, the key to human success is to be strong and to crush those who are weak. And the idea of celebrating those who are weak, I mean, you're just inviting people to be failures, aren't you? You're just validating cruelty and suffering, aren't you? And so it was a major barrier to him. Cheese on a cross? No thanks, says Nietzsche. I don't suppose there's many sort of devoted followers of Nietzsche here, but maybe that's the thing about Christianity that you find difficult. you know, Christianity not just about success and the best life now, but Christianity about sacrifice, about saying no to stuff, giving stuff up. Maybe even as we're doing the illustration about the sin, you're like, why shouldn't I enjoy my sin? Why do I have to give this up? You know, it's so negative, this Christianity. Get rid of this, get rid of this, no to this. And then no to life itself. You know, all living for another life in another fairy tale world, maybe you think. It just seems so weird. But it is not just the outsider who thinks that the cross is weird. Isaiah gets it wrong. And that's the thing that's most striking for me. So Isaiah, he's on the inside track, right? He gets a lot of this. He's a prophet, a Jewish prophet. And he says, we got it wrong. Because as we considered this king dying, we thought he must have failed. Now, I know if you're a Christian, I know you know that Good Friday is good. That's why we call it Good Friday. I know we talk about the cross as a victory. But is there in us just that, oh, we kind of wish there was a different kind of Christianity? There was success kind of get ahead, get rich, be happy, be healthy, prosper at the expense of everyone else kind. You know, like the, if only I could have a Christian version of what everyone else is living for in London, you know, the high paid job, the lovely holidays. Maybe we have that, but the idea of self-denial and suffering and embracing weakness and, oh, I don't really want that in my Christianity. And it's just a bit awkward that that's the example that Jesus is offering, maybe. Isaiah said, I was wrong. Well, why was he wrong then? Okay, so he sees somebody, he's nothing special about him, he's not particularly attractive, he dies in weakness. We did not esteem him. Verse 3. In other words, we didn't think he counted. And he says, I was wrong because, point 2, in fact, Jesus' weakness, his suffering, his death was for us, taking the punishment that we deserve. Just look at verse 4. Surely he has borne or carried our griefs. He carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken. In other words, we thought he was the one who was in trouble, but actually, turns out, he was taking our trouble. We thought he was the one smitten by God, hit and beaten by God, afflicted by God, but he was wounded for our transgressions. A transgression is when you break the law or disobey God's commands. He was wounded for what we'd done. He was crushed for our iniquities. An iniquity is like the stain of sin. When there's something you do and the sort of bad connotation, or the bad memory of it, the guilt of it lingers, sticks to you, iniquities. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement, the punishment that brought us peace. With his stripes, we are healed. Yeah, the flogging, the beating, the crown of thorns, the death in weakness. That was due to me, and he took it. And I'm just going to borrow, I've done this before, when the children's illustration is so good that I borrowed it, so I'm going to do it now. But I'm not going to manage all of them, because I think Nathan had more practice with balancing them than I can manage now. But, you know, you see someone with sin laid on them, and they die, and you think God must really be against that person. That's what the Jews thought. You know, somebody that is being crucified. The Jewish scripture said in the book of Deuteronomy that cursed is anyone hung on a tree. So as a Jew looked at Jesus, the Jewish king, so-called, dying on a tree, they said God's cursed him, God's against him. He must have done something wrong to deserve that. But Isaiah said, then I figured out that the sins he was dying for were ours, not his. He took them off us. That's why he died. That's why I was wrong about him. It's not a failure, but an incredibly courageous act of self-sacrifice. Jesus died for us, taking the punishment that we deserve. And then, thirdly, as a result of that, well, it turns out that we receive peace and healing. You see that in verse 5? Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. With his stripes, we are healed. Because actually sin, it messes up the world. It breaks relationships. You know, when we wrong somebody else and it hurts them, it causes damage. All of us know this. Things that we regret, even though we may not say that we regret them because we don't like to say that we're wrong, hurt people and break things. Relationships get wrecked. Trust is destroyed. Happiness is soured. And it's the same with God. You know, we wrong God. We ignore him. We reject him. It messes up the relationship. There's consequences for it. It destroys peace. Brings trouble. But Isaiah said, I realized that Jesus, this servant, he took my sins away. Because he died for them, he paid for them, he was punished for them. So it would be like the consequences of my sin were gone. Peace. Because sin breaks peace. Sin causes conflict between us. But now peace, because he took it away. Sin causes death. But now healing, because Jesus took the sin away. One of my friends, a good friend of mine, I lived with for 3 years, I think about 15 years ago, something like that. A guy called Andy Gears. He's now married and got children and lives in Hampstead. When 15 years ago, when I was living with him, his great aim was to create a computer game to explain the Christian story. And he was into computer games, and he thought this is a great medium to, you know, young people are more interested in computer games than they are into books. But actually, computer games were about narratives and stories. So why don't I just put the Christian story into a computer game? This was his great project 15 years ago. And he's basically been working on it all the way through those last 15 years. I mean, he used to spend hours in his room. He's a computer programmer, techie guy. So he did all the sort of coding. I'm looking at some techie people right now, Rahim. And then he realized I need creative people, Abigail. So he got together a team of, I need the techie guy and the artistic guy, and then some musical people to do a soundtrack. And it basically all just, he paid for it himself or got crowdfunders to do it. Became this massive thing, years and years and years. It got released on the App Store last week. And so on the plane back from Athens yesterday, I downloaded it and I played the whole thing. I have to say, I'm not very good at computer games, so I got stuck a lot of times. But it took me through the whole story. And I don't want to spoil the whole thing for you because, you know, you could play it. It's called The Serpent and the Seed. Andy Gears, I'm advertising your game at Grace Church Greenwich today, so you can thank me later. The Serpent and the Seed. But one of the really cool things, there's this scene where Jesus dies, obviously, if you're telling the Christian story, you've got to have that. And then straight after Jesus dies, they enter into this sort of destroyed, broken, cursed world where everything is spoiled and all the relationships are broken and nothing really grows. But because of the power of Jesus' death, you're able to pick bits of it and paint over them. And they become uncursed and liberated and beautiful. And it's all black and white, and then you scratch over it and it becomes colorful. And then vegetation sprouts, and it's a beautiful garden. And then sad people turn into happy people, and people who are diseased or disabled suddenly throw away their crutches and they become. Now at this point you're a bit scared, right? You're thinking, is he saying that disabled people should throw away their crutches? Is this one of those sort of crazy Christian messages? And yeah, that's what this is saying. That's what we have the second reading from Matthew's gospel. He goes into a town, there's people who are sick. Jesus heals those who are sick because, you know, he's powerful. He's got God's power to do that. But then Matthew says, to fulfill what was written in the prophet Isaiah, and he quotes from this passage, he healed all their diseases. So Matthew is saying, Jesus ability to heal people stems directly from this. He takes away the sin that destroys everything. And then comes the transformation. And it's actually the most, I mean, it's what I was just about to land. In fact, I think maybe I even did land. And then on the Elizabeth line, I did the last scene back from Heathrow last night. It made me kind of happy because it's quite fun restoring the world with your finger on a computer game. But it's even more beautiful to imagine this world restored, broken relationships mended, diseases healed. A really good friend of mine, a long-term friend of mine, I've known for 20-something years, has got cancer. At the moment, I know this happens every now and then. A whole succession of people, isn't it? It does seem to be. But she's just heard. She messaged me last week, asking if I'd preach at her funeral. Gosh, that makes me sad. You know, somebody that I really care about her a lot. And she's just basically got to the point that the doctors can't help anymore. So she's gone home to be made as comfortable as she can be. You know, what a glorious day it will be when she is healed. I don't mean by that we're expecting every Christian with cancer to get better. That's the wrong understanding. I do mean that because of what Jesus did, in the end, on the final day, on the day of resurrection, people who die with cancer will be better. Jesus did a kind of some previews of that when he did his miracles, but Jesus was never predicting that all Christians would be healthy. But he gave a little demo in his miracles that I have the power to do that, not just in a computer game, to kind of scratch over the black and white and turn it colorful, and scratch over the person with crutches and they dance, and scratch over the person with tears and then they smile. It's fun to do on the game, even more fun for Jesus to do in real life. He gave a preview of the miracles that people attest historically that he did, but it's just a taste of what he will do in the end. But it comes from this, says Matthew. Because he bore our griefs and carried our sorrows and was wounded for our transgressions and was crushed for our iniquities, and upon him was the punishment that meant that to me came peace, verse 5. And with his stripes, the flogging and the crown of thorns and the nails and the awful treatment, because of that comes healing to me. And so Isaiah says, I got this wrong. And my question today for all of us, and myself included, is, have we got it wrong about Jesus? Yeah, did we underestimate what happened that Good Friday 2,000 years ago, the literally cosmic implications of it? The power to heal, to transform, to mend, to fix this broken world. The power to reconcile, to undo the consequences of evil, to even to undo death itself. Because he bought, did we underestimate that? Did we think it an insignificant thing? A guy 2,000 years ago, he started a religious movement and it went wrong and he got killed. So I said, I was wrong about that. Or are we wrong about the kind of Christian life we're expecting? You know, you're hoping for one of constant victory and riches and freedom from pain. That's not the deal yet. In the end, it is. The deal now is we follow a Messiah who died in weakness, and then in the end, life, healing, restoration. Isaiah said he was despised, and we, even me, the Jewish prophet, he should know better, did not esteem him. But then I realized something much more amazing was going on. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. For us, peace, we trust in him. Freedom. The consequences of the things that we've done wrong that we're ashamed of, wiped out. Death itself, reversed. good news this Easter. Praise God. I'm going to leave a pause just for us to reflect on our own in our hearts, and then we're going to pray together, and we'll be led in prayer as a whole church. Thank you.